Stillman and Company, 1025, 1063, the game, streaming live on Twitter, Twitch, YouTube, and Facebook Live. We are live from the Busy Bee Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning Game Nashville Studios. We are presented by the Southern Bank of Tennessee, and it is a Fireball Hot Take Friday. And we are joined out here at Hawkins Field, where Vanderbilt is about an hour away from first pitch, the number one seed in the NCAA baseball tournament. Although the good guys did win the first game. I went to Louisville, so you know.
Okay, it's, all right, I get it.
Joined by Vanderbilt football coach Clark Lee. First of all, I got to say this, you know, when we said we were going to be out here, I was not expecting you to be on the show today because I heard today was a very big day for you, giving the commencement address at your alma mater.
That's right.
MBA. How about that?
Well, so that was actually yesterday.
Oh, that was yesterday. I thought that was today.
Listen, I've got the commencement hangover today, I guess. No, commencement yesterday, that was awesome. It's a full circle moment. Cool to be a part of that. I was appreciative. And then today is official visit. So I gave my campus tour, just a little bit ago. We're in between some events right now and nothing I'd rather do than come hang out with you.
Okay. So I want to start with this. In Destin, all the talk, at least for us that weren't in Destin, was playoff, 4-4-2-2 versus 5-11. I'm a big 5-11 guy. I think just trying to read the tea leaves, it seems like the Big 12 is a 5-11 conference. The ACC is in favor of 5-11. The commissioner is in favor of 5-11. You, the football coaches, are in favor of 5-11. The Big 10 and the ADs, the Big 10 is for the 4-4-2-2. It seems like the ADs are a little split as to what's going to happen. What was your kind of experience in Destin surrounding all the chatter about the future of the playoff?
Well, there's a lot of numbers and there's a lot of tangling of webs there. But I think ultimately, first of all, and I say this all the time, this was my fifth trip to Destin. To be in those meetings at a time where the world is changing, you know, every day. I mean, it's fascinating and I appreciate being a part of what hopefully becomes a solution to some of the challenges we face. When you look at it and you think about, I mean, there's all this is tied into one package. It's 8 games, 9 games. It's how are we formatting the playoffs? You know, a lot of our responses as coaches looking at the success of our basketball teams, in terms of fielding the 64 with SEC teams, obviously with SEC success in baseball and softball, getting their teams into, the playoff, fields. You know, for us, it's appealing as football coaches. We believe in our product. We believe in what we're building. We want as many opportunities to compete for a national championship as we can. And, you know, obviously the 5-11 gives us those opportunities. Now, it doesn't give us guarantees. So there's the trade-off. But all of it is tied together. And I think, you know, Commissioner's done a great job. He obviously the complexity of his world right now and his leadership, trying to make the best decision for the conference, but also keep the what's best for the game in mind. And, you know, the in-between of ADs, coaches, and the likes. I don't envy him for what he's dealing with. But what we're looking for as coaches is give us a chance to be as competitive as we can be for the ultimate prize. That's what excites us. That's what we sign up for. And that's what we want to do.
So I'm going to put you on the spot by asking you, whose opinion matters more in this, yours or Candace's? And are you and Candace, you know, do you guys talk it out? And then whatever the consensus is between the two of you, like, hey, if the AD says, Clark, we're in support of 5-11 or we're in support of 4-4-2-2, that you then have to be in support of 4-4-2-2. How does that work?
Well, just like with any issue that's complex, there's you can see this from both perspectives. And not to get into the kind of granular details of why an AD may feel one way and a coach may feel another. Our ability in the coach's room too, we see the vantage point on both sides. Yeah. I'm really fortunate because Candace and I are super aligned.
Sure.
And, you know, we need to spend some time coming out of the Destin meetings and just really make sure that we're seeing this the same way. But, you know, we've had multiple conversations around what's best for us, what's best for Vanderbilt, what's best for the SEC. And, you know, we tend to see the world the same way. So, I'm fortunate that way. Obviously, look, if there's a decision to be made, she is the boss. And so in all these are relationships. We ultimately serve the athletic director. We all serve the chancellor, and everyone has a seat at that table and everyone's, you know, contributing to this decision.
Can I ask you on record right now, are you in favor of the 5'11 versus the 4'4"?
I am. Again, go back to just, can we be competitive for as many spots as we possibly can? And I would also say, you know, just like anything, that the conditions continue to shift on this, and you know, there are new ideas being formed. I think part of the challenge is that we have to have a point where the new ideas cease, and sure, we take the ones we have to depth and play them out and see what works the best. But so I want to hold a little room there to be able to adjust and adapt that opinion. But coming out of Destin, I mean, again, as a competitor, you know, I'd love to see them just go 1-16, have a great formula for delivering what the 16 best teams are, and let's let it rip. But, you know, to me, the 5'11 gives us the most opportunities to compete for spots. And I think that's a great thing.
Here's what I don't get, which is, let's say that you go 4-4-2-2. So how do we decide the four teams? Like, so both teams that go to the SEC championship game make it to the playoff? Well, then what's the point of having the SEC championship game?
Yeah.
And then how do we decide the other two? Do we play 3 versus 6 and then we play 4 versus 5? Or is it just, hey, you finished third, you finished fourth, you got, I don't understand any of that.
I don't know that that's all been nailed down. And there are, I think there are multiple pathways to four. And I think some of that can create excitement around the end of the season, but I don't want to go too far down that because again, I'll mess it up, but
sure.
Again, I think they're still ironing that out, those details and how that would actually come to be, could add some excitement. Again, anytime you put, a qualifier, you put limitation, that would just be my perspective as I sit with you this afternoon. And the fewer limitations we put on our league, you know, as coaches, we bet on this league to be the best of the best. And we want to have the chance to, again, look, we got to lift that ultimate trophy at the end of the year. And as many teams as we can get in, we feel like we got a strong league top to bottom, and we want to go take our swings at it.
Vanderbilt football coach Clark Lee with us on the program. The 8 games versus the 9 games, where do you sit on that?
Well, you know, I think, again, as you pay attention to the formatting of the playoffs, you know, we want to make sure we're strengthening our conference's position.
Why does this go hand in hand?
Well, what we learned a year ago is that right now, the way it is, every loss counts, you know, and we have a really, really challenging league, and that's a great thing. But, you know, we want to, if you just look at the way, again, you know, seeding happens in the basketball tournament, or selection happens in the basketball tournament, selection happening in the baseball tournament, it's a more of an objective process. And so what happens is it all becomes very merit-based. And what you see is, you know, I don't know that you would know, but do we have 8 of the 16 host sites? Is that what it is?
I think it's something like that. Yeah, it's the top, yeah, 4. And
yeah, it's amazing. And for good reason. You see some baseball programs that are right around 500 in our league, you know, getting a chance to play in the postseason. And listen, some of those teams that are right around 500 are really good baseball teams that'll make their way through regionals, make their way through super regionals, and have a chance in Omaha, again, to win the ultimate prize. That's the depth and the strength of our conference. And so playing a ninth game, there's a reason to do that just from another quality game on the schedule. But we want to make sure that in doing that, you know, there's this awareness that, whether that's a quality win or a quality loss, that it's gonna have a positive impact on the way that we're judged in selection for the playoffs.
Clark Lee's with us on the program. I do want to ask you about you and not just about everything that happened in Destin. So my first thing would be, after the past season that you had, what, when it comes to your team, are you most proud of?
Oh, you know, I mean, I think, being a 2-2 team right at the, you know, kind of through that first third, where we had an emotional win and we handled business against Alcorn State. And then you go on the road against Georgia State and you really play poorly, credit to them, and then lose the double overtime.
Just worried about you after the Georgia State game, the way that all went down.
That was a hard, I mean, you know, it's interesting, you know, you know, I appreciate if it's my well-being, if it's my job. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, for me, there's nothing externally that kind of takes me off course. I know it's hard sometimes to imagine, but like you're just so insulated and focused on your team. And what I saw in the Georgia State game wasn't necessarily like a distracted team, but we did not show up and play the way we needed to play. And it took, I always say, it took us too long to get involved in that game, and it was too late. Mm-hmm. But I knew just like beating Virginia Tech at the beginning of the season, no one game was going to define the year. And we're not great prognosticators. You know, we just try to stay in the moment. So we go then to Missouri and obviously drop a heartbreaker there where, you know, we really felt like we had a chance to win against, at the time, a team that was ranked really high on the road. And both locker rooms after those games, it was not a defeated team. They were disappointed. I mean, they were pissed. They were upset, but the resolve that we built as a program, it just felt different. I mean, go back to the first game that we ever lost here with me, the coach, was against East Tennessee State. And there was a point at which we were up.
I was worried about your well-being after that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think a lot of people were, they care about me, you know, I worry about that guy too, because that was a hard night. We were up 3-0. I think there was a point at which they went up 7-3, and that may have been in the second quarter. But the way that took the life out of our sideline, that in that moment, like, was a wake up call to me. Like, this is the challenge. How do you sharpen mentalities and attitudes, and create resilience? So anyways, 2-2, and we go into a bye week and have a great Sunday practice, and we have a great, you know, extra week of prep, and then to come back and be able to play four quarters the way we played against Alabama. And that game was not straightforward. Okay. That was, you know, us jumping out, them counterpunching, you know, this back and forth, this ebb and flow, where the confidence and the belief of our team never wavered. And we played with identity, played to our strategy, and it worked. That was a moment, not because of Alabama, but because of the team, where we were, how we'd battled, and what we needed to do to find the year that we wanted to have. I would say that moment, and then the win at Auburn, where I just felt like we squeezed everything out of the tube. If you look at the numbers from that game, and I don't have them in my mind, but our offensive output and, you know, the way we played on defense, you know, we that was complimentary football at its best, because Diego was beat up. That was a good Auburn team. They were talented, and we just found a way on the road. And so all of that gave way to the bowl win. So those 3 points to me, the 2-2 team that stepped into its belief, but also found that identity and strategy, the sixth win at Auburn, which to me was our group giving everything they could. I didn't like the 3 losses there to finish the year, but I felt like we had the right spirit and attitude. We just weren't able to sustain performance. Once we got healthy for the bowl game, I was really proud of the way that we played against Georgia Tech, and to finish the season lifting a trophy was meaningful to everyone who supports our program, but certainly to us on the inside. I mean, that was a special moment.
Okay, now I'm going to ask you personally, what is the thing you're most proud of yourself that's happened in the last year?
There's been a lot of discovery for me. I mean, this is the story personally about evolution and about growth. And
because it's got to be hard. You know, you're paid a lot of money. You are coaching in the playoff at Notre Dame. You take the Vanderbilt job. You say, here's my plan. And then midway through, it's like, okay, back to the drawing board. Got to rip up the plan and start over.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think there are foundational things that we have done here that we've done since the beginning that are really quality. And that has set a course for success and breakthrough. And so I'm proud of those things. There are things that we did at the beginning that we have grown beyond, that were still important at our beginning, but at this point as a program, we need to have matured from them. Things like the jersey numbers and stuff like that. I thought that was appropriate for where we were at the start. Obviously we've moved past it, but there are also things that I've grown through. And some of that is this idea that control is an illusion. You know, as a coach, you're really dependent upon the choices of your staff and your team. And that so much of that's about, you have a vision for the program, and it has to be my vision. Anything that becomes multiple agendas becomes distracted. So when you talk about hiring a staff and aligning on a vision, that is my job. So from the top to the bottom, we all see the mission the same way. We understand how to actualize it. we recognize the things that represent our program and the things we don't. And so as I've kind of like let go of some of the control and looked and said to say, how do I empower people to bring their creative energy to this, give them autonomy, allow them to not belong to something that is so hyper structured that it takes their individuality from them, but instead ask them to bring that individuality to something that we align on. It's created an energy and a spirit internally that I'm really proud of. But you asked about me personally. This has been a journey of growth for me. It's a story of resilience, and there's more learning ahead, man. We're so excited about where we are. I feel for the first time the pulse of our community around this, which, man, and you know, as a Nashvillean, like, that means more to me than anything. Sure. To drive the city, see Vanderbilt flags, to have people come up to me and be interested, because I believe there's so many good things about what we're building. But we're not guaranteed anything by way of progress. As we strengthen, the league strengthens. The better we get, the more that we're not sneaking up on people. And so there's a lot of learning ahead, but to get up and to go, you know this, because it's true for you too. When you love what you do and you step into it every day and you make mistakes and you learn from mistakes and you feel this growth, how much better are you now than when you first started?
Sure. Right?
And I think that part of this, independent of the performance, independent of what's judged, the internal parts of this have been so invigorating to me. And I'm having a lot of fun with it.
Clark Lee, as always, man, good to see you.
Great to see you too.
Your ride's right here for you.
Yeah, we're good
right
to go.
There. I love it. Good luck with the recruiting this weekend. We'll talk soon.
Hey, and you know what? Best to Corbs. Never count this guy out. What a fun team to watch and get behind. So hoping for the best for the Vandy boys.
Except for tomorrow night.
We can talk about that.
Clark Lee, Stillman & Company. We continue 102.5 The Game. Stillman & Company live out here at Vanderbilt today ahead of the Vandy Regional. Again, keeping our eye on Louisville. We will see how that goes. Chad Withrow joins us now from Outkick, as he always does on a Friday a little bit earlier today, presented by the Southern Bank of Tennessee. So, Chad, I want to start with this. I am of the belief that when it comes to this new system that the college football playoff is inevitably heading to, this 16-team playoff, I am convinced that the SEC would be better off with the 5+11 model. And yet it feels like there's one hurdle to get over. The ACC says they're 5+11. The Big 12 says 5+11. The Big 10 wants the 4 automatic bids. The SEC coaches are 5+11, but the SEC AD seem hesitant. Can I ask you why?
Yeah, I don't know why the ADs are more hesitant. I think it's just everybody likes a nice, neat guarantee of how many teams they're going to get. And then if you go above and beyond that, great. I just think that we're having two separate conversations here. I went on a radio show in Pennsylvania yesterday, and all of Big Ten country is up in arms over who they see as Greg Sankey basically being Bane from the Batman movies. Right. You know, he's got his hand on the face of all of college football, asking them if they feel in control right now, because he's going to call the shots and he's going to dictate what happens. Now, the two separate conversations is this: what's good for the game? What's good for a college football fan that's a fan of Louisville or a fan of Baylor or a fan of Cal, versus what's good for SEC and Big Ten fans if you're a fan of one of those schools? And what Greg Sankey is saying unequivocally is that basically I don't need a lecture about the good of the game. I'm not about the good of the game. I'm about what's good for the SEC, and I'm going to look out for number one. Now we could sit and have the separate debate about, well, isn't what's good for the overall national brand and game of college football, isn't that ultimately good for the SEC? I think to some extent, yes. But what Greg Sankey knows, and I think what Tony Petitti in the Big Ten knows, is that whatever they're giving the other conferences, they're giving them. So if the Big 12 and the ACC want to come out and talk about, yeah, we're going to accept these two teams from our conferences because someone's got to look out for what's good for the game. I mean, Greg Sankey's going to come back and argue, we don't have to give you anything. Hmm. We really don't. I mean, that's the scary part about this, Jared, is that Greg Sankey could come back and say, you know what? Have fun getting television networks to pay more than what they're going to pay us in the Big Ten, and then whoever else we decide to raid from your conference, whether that be Florida State, North Carolina, Clemson, Baylor, whoever that is, we're going to go get whoever we want to bring into what's going to be the National Football League of college football. And then we're going to go and we're going to go to all the networks, and we're going to have a very NFL type tight system of how we broadcast the games. All of them are going to be across all the big networks, and we're going to make a killing doing that and have fun getting people to watch your playoffs if that happens. So look, I don't always agree with Greg Sankey. And I think when you start looking out for money over everything else and not factoring anything else in, that's going to get you into a lot of trouble. But I think what people are having a hard time with are these two different conversations. Mm-hmm. What's good for the game as we know it, you know, going back 30, 40 years, as we all like it with college football, versus the realities of today and who can actually afford to spend the money and make the money that it's going to cost for college football to exist at the highest level. And what is that highest level and who gets to be included in the highest level? That's what Greg Sankey's looking at. And he's saying it very honestly. And I think he's unfairly getting criticized for just really being completely honest and transparent about what his job is. And that's to service the 16 member institutions of the SEC and no one else.
Chad, I have a theory, which is the Big Ten, I believe, is trying for the 4-4-2-2 model because they're trying to put themselves on equal footing with the SEC. And I know the Big Ten's won the last two national titles, and I'm not taking anything away from Ohio State, Michigan, Oregon, or even Penn State. But the Big Ten, in my opinion, is not the SEC. They may make more money because their TV contract is more recent, but I believe they're trying to get on equal footing with the SEC with the 4-4-2-2 model. Notre Dame is the one team that when we talk about the good for the game, that I don't want to say they can't do this without, but I feel like Notre Dame is kind of the one team that they could do this without the entire Big 12. Sorry, Arizona State. Sorry, BYU. Sorry, Big 12. Texas Tech. Sorry, ACC, Clemson, Miami, Florida State. They can do this without them. I don't think they can do this without Notre Dame. If you're Notre Dame, do you consider eventually making the full-on move to the ACC? Now, you're going to have to get more money than everybody else because that's part of the deal. But Notre Dame to the ACC, I do feel like, would put the ACC in somewhat equal footing, maybe not money-wise, but from a team depth standpoint with the Big Ten. Where do you see Notre Dame playing a role in all of this? Because they're not talked about that much.
Well, first off, it makes a ton of sense what you're laying out for the ACC. Like, that's a no-brainer. If they could get Notre Dame, they've been trying for years, then they would get Notre Dame. Like, yeah, that would help save the ACC and all this and definitely put them on more of equal footing with the Big Ten.
The ACC took Stanford and Cal into the Atlantic Coast because Notre Dame wanted them to do it.
Yeah, but look, here's the problem with that. Like, yeah, for the ACC, from their standpoint, absolutely go all in, do whatever you can. Bring Notre Dame on board, and that could put you on equal footing with the Big Ten. Notre Dame, there's no reason for them to do that right now. Like, they can sit back with their television contract. They can let everybody else go to war. They can see what happens. They can let Greg Sankey issue press releases about how great the SEC is, and they can listen to Tony Petitti talk about the Big Ten's market value and everything else. And then when the chips start falling, they can just jump wherever they want because anyone's going to want Notre Dame. Whatever this hypothetical NFL of college football that I keep talking about, whenever that happens, Notre Dame's a part of it and they know it. So why would they jump on board the ACC, who's only getting two seats at the table in the college football playoff right now, when either the SEC or the Big Ten would be happy to add Notre Dame? But also, they have no incentive to do it right now because they don't know what the SEC and Big Ten's going to be, because this could be part of whatever this new alliance of college football is going to look like, and what we think of SEC and Big Ten may not quite be the same. Now, I don't think either one of those conferences want to get away from the history they have of that brand of SEC and Big Ten, so we're still going to see that in some way, shape, or form. But from an ACC perspective, absolutely do it. I just don't see any reason why Notre Dame would want to do that right now, and they are the one. I mean, I can argue the merits of Florida State, Clemson, you know, some other programs that are out there.
Miami.
But you're right in that, yeah, Miami's a good one too. I think Baylor, because of the money, because of some of their recent success, is one that's interesting also. But from a just you have to have them, it's definitely Notre Dame. And also the Wake Forest of the world, those are the ones that have to be really nervous right now. Because, I mean, if the ACC was restructuring, even in the current landscape, what their conference looks like, they're probably cutting Wake Forest, you know, out of their conference. So that's where it gets really tricky. Some of these programs, they don't have a life preserver. And we're going to find that out very soon. And when the dust settles on all of this, Notre Dame is going to be a part of it. But they have the luxury right now of just sitting back and waiting to see what happens.
Chad Withrow with us on the program. So they announced some start times of the schedule and everything else for college football. This is the one I'm sure you saw. I'm sure you saw this. I am certain of it. Have you seen the first four games on CBS next season?
Yeah.
Okay. Nevada, Penn State week one, Oklahoma State, Oregon week two, USC at Purdue week three, Michigan at Nebraska week four. Somebody has to explain something to me. You know, the NBA, their TV ratings go down, 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 and yet the money they get goes up, up, up. Somebody has to explain to me why the Big Ten, why CBS and NBC decided to go all in on the second and third game of the Big Ten when one of those two channels could have just bought the Pac-12 before USC, UCLA, Oregon, and Washington bolted for the Big Ten. Somebody needs to explain this to me because, I'm sorry, that slate of games, those games suck. What is happening here? Why is CBS, and I understand they didn't want to pay the SEC's ransom, but I feel like they paid an exorbitant amount of money for Nevada, Penn State.
Yeah, I think it was a bad move. Look, on its face, I can see why you would make that decision. Oh, we're not going to pay what the SEC wants. And the Big Ten does really well in ratings, and they got some good football there too, and enormous, you know, fan bases and enormous alumni bases and all that. So we'll just go to the next conference, the Big Ten, and then we'll pay them an exorbitant amount of money. But when you start to look at these schedules, and you just nailed those first 4 weeks, I mean, the only one there of any value to me is Michigan-Nebraska. And I don't know how good Nebraska is going to be. We don't really know how good Michigan's going to be, but that's the one I look at. I'm like, okay, those are two brands that I'm, you know, people are probably going to watch. But those other games, goodness, it's terrible. And you bring up an interesting idea, Jared, because I've always thought this. If it's all about TV and the networks are going to make decisions and they're going to swing the big bat when they come up to the plate, why didn't some network just come in and say, we're going to give the Pac-12 money to stay afloat? Mm-hmm. It's going to be a lot of money. But in doing that, you know, it's like a hostile takeover, right? I'm going to go to a company and I'm going to get 51% of the shares publicly, and now I'm the controlling owner of that company. So if CBS comes in and says, we're going to pay a ton of money to the Pac-12. We've lost the SEC. We don't want to pay what the Big Ten is offering. We're going to offer a ton of money to the Pac-12. We're going to give them a life raft and give them a ton of money, and we're going to keep the conference together. And we're going to go get a television package for the ACC. And we're going to give them a good chunk of money. But in doing that, we're going to play matchmaker here. So we're going to see a couple of Miami versus Oregon games that are going to air on CBS, right? We're going to pair Florida State and Washington together in a home-and-home series. And we're going to carry that on CBS. So not only – it's kind of like the Notre Dame partnership with the ACC with scheduling, right? Not only are you saving one conference in the Pac-12, but you're investing less money but still money – into the ACC with the understanding that because you can tell the ADs what to do now, hey, you guys are going to schedule each other in the non-conference. We're going to have some premier early season games and maybe even one in November that's going to be sort of this ACC Pac-12 challenge. And the biggest teams in the conference, of our choosing, by the way, as the network, are going to play each other in some really sexy cross-coast matchups. Pacific Coast versus Atlantic Coast. Let's go. That makes more sense than what is it, Nevada and Penn State?
Yes.
That's going to open the season. Like that would be very interesting to me that, you know, what people want more than anything, more than money, more than fame, more than any of that is power. They want decision-making power. They want power over something. That is the way that you could have power as a network more than anything else. The networks have almost no power with the NFL. Like the NFL calls all the shots. The networks spend a ton of money, and then they are constantly told what to do by the NFL just to have the privilege of showing NFL games. you could take over the power if you were CBS and you bailed out the Pac-12 and you gave a bunch of money to the ACC to help with their television revenue for all of their teams. And then you can start to decide what games are played.
Now, you can't do that with the ACC because of their grant of rights with the ESPN. But to your point, like at that point in time, when they lost the SEC, because they lost the SEC, I want to say like during the COVID shutdowns is when they lost the SEC. You know, they had a couple more years of the SEC, but they knew that they were going to lose it. At that point in time, to your point, they should have immediately pivoted to the Pac-12 or the Big 12, who had their primary rights available. Is the game of the week in the Pac-12, and we're talking about the old Pac-12 with USC, UCLA, Oregon, Washington, Colorado, etc. Is the game of the week in the Pac-12 the same as the game of the week in the SEC? No. Nobody's arguing that. But at the same time, is USC, Oregon better than Oklahoma State, Oregon? And the answer to me is yes. And that's the problem here. I mean, I think to your point, what you're talking about, I think that's what NBC does. NBC's like, we get one Big Ten game and we get Notre Dame. And whichever one is the better game that week, we'll put on in primetime. So we'll put on Notre Dame in primetime. But this Big Ten schedule, I mean, this is just garbage. I mean, can CBS is paying all this money. Can they get a good game? I mean, did they even get a good game last year? Like Gary Danielson, he's retired. He must be like, I'm not doing these games anymore because these games suck.
I mean, think about Gary Danielson went from calling, you know, Georgia, Alabama at night to calling Purdue, Michigan State.
Yeah.
On a Saturday afternoon. It's crazy. And I remember when the news broke, I think it was right around that first COVID weekend where there were some like Sunbelt games being played. You know, this is before the SEC started their season in 2020 when they started in, what, late September or early October. So it was right around Labor Day weekend that it was announced that they had lost the rights and they were going to move on from SEC on CBS in 2020. So, yeah, I mean, they had plenty of time to plan. And take what I'm, you know, yeah, you're right about the ACC grant of rights. I'm saying with any conference, could be Big 12 and Pac-12.
Sure.
But essentially, a network can become matchmaker. It's what the SEC and Big Ten are talking about. Hey, let's go ahead and plan a weekend or a couple weekends where it's basically an SEC Big Ten invitational and we'll go head to head. So, I mean, I really like what Brian Kelly said that the coaches are in favor of. The SEC will play 9 conference games, 1 game against the Big Ten and 2 games of your choosing. So now LSU can go play McNeese State if they want. Tennessee can play Tennessee Tech in 1 game. And then you're going to go play a Sunbelt team, right, in another game. Just like the Big Ten will face a couple of MAC teams with their other 2 games on their schedule. I'm all for that. I mean, if you add a big Big Ten versus SEC game added to all those great conference games in the SEC, it's going to make every schedule tougher, but I'm all for that model. That's sort of what I'm talking about, the way television networks could start to interfere by pumping money into these conferences and forcing them to play games against each other and making a more desirable television product, because what CBS has right now is not good.
Chad Withrow with us on the program on a Fireball Hot Take Friday. To the hot seat next. Stillman & Company, 102.5, 106.3 The Game. Stillman & Company, 102.5, 106.3 The Game, out here live at Vanderbilt, the Vanderbilt pregame show ahead of Wright State to follow us. Chad Withrow with us from Outkick, presented by the Southern Bank of Tennessee. Chad, do you have a thought, or do you want to go right to the hot seat?
Let's get right to it.
Okay. Number one, Brian Callahan last week told us all about his new 8-team team building, team work, leadership development, etc. plan. And Jeffrey Simmons was the only player absent from OTAs this week. Do the Titans have a Jeffrey Simmons problem?
Well, they got a leadership problem, and that starts with Jeffrey Simmons. So, yes, they've got a Jeffrey Simmons problem, because Jeffrey Simmons is the guy now that when you say Tennessee Titans, that people are talking about. Now, Cam Ward, obviously, is number one pick, is going to be that guy. But, I mean, how often have we heard about Jeffrey Simmons being this great defensive lineman, being this great player, the stalwart for the Titans on some bad teams? Boy, but Jeffrey Simmons is truly great, and he leads by example, and he gets after it. Well, okay, if that's true, you got to lead by example, and you got to get after it, and you need to be there at OTA. So, yeah, I mean, I think this is just another symptom of a bigger problem with the Titans, where without Derrick Henry, And without Mike Vrabel, quite frankly, who I think was a strong leader, even though he made some mistakes with his coaching staff, no doubt about it, but he set a tone for the team. I just think it's a team that lacks an identity. And when you start playing these campfire games, where you're going on a corporate retreat, basically, and going through the eight tenets of your great organization or whatever you're doing, you're just searching for an identity. You're searching for leadership. And I think if you're going to go out and try to create leaders as men, as adults, then you're doing it wrong. You need to draft leaders. You need to bring leaders in free agency. You need to identify who has leadership capabilities, and those leaders have to lead. And I do think that Jeffrey Simmons is respected by teammates, and I think he's a very good player. That's the type of guy who should be leading for you. This is not a sign of leadership to me, though, with him. He needs to be there. He needs to be leading. He needs to be helping Brian Callahan, and he's not, and that's not a good thing for the Titans.
Number two, Justin Fields believes, quote, he can be great with the New York Jets. The Jets have gone all in on Justin Fields. Do you still have faith in Justin Fields?
I reserve a little glimmer of hope for Justin Fields. I'm not completely out on him. I think that he was dealt a very bad hand in Chicago, and some of it was him, no doubt. It was a very odd situation in Pittsburgh with Russell Wilson and sort of the back and forth with those two. So I think there is a possibility of a clean slate start where he kind of jump starts his career in an unorthodox fashion. I think of Geno Smith. You know, when he got to Seattle, I did not see Geno Smith being a solid to very good NFL quarterback, especially statistically. And that's what he became. So I do have a little bit of hope for Justin Fields. Now, will the Jets screw it up just like, you know, another bad organization with quarterbacks, the Chicago Bears did? Maybe. But I think that he is still a good player, and I give a little bit of hope that he can turn it around with the Jets.
Tennessee baseball hosting a regional as well this weekend. Number three, if Tennessee does not make it out of the regional in Knoxville, will this have been a disappointing year for Tony Vitello?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I did also read a stat, which is crazy to me, that like the defending national champion, Tennessee's the first one to host a regional the following year in like 10 years. That typically the team that wins it all just goes off a cliff the next season. It's been a while since a team won it all and then hosted a regional.
I'm going to guess that was probably Vandy in 2015, probably was the last one.
Yeah, it's been a while. And maybe there's a team after that, but there's been a lot of examples. Like LSU, you know, went from winning it all with Paul Skeens to being really bad, I think, the next year. So it has been sort of a trend. I think where Tony Vitello has this team is it's at least super regional or bust, right? I mean, you win a national title, and it was a steady climb to get to the mountaintop, to get to that national title. They've got really good talent. They recruit really well. I mean, I would just blanket statement say every year coming into the season, it is super regionals or better for Tennessee, right? That's what Tim Corbin built at Vanderbilt. You know, that's kind of what we forgot was like that. Vanderbilt fans are upset if they're not in the super regional or College World Series because of all of Tim Corbin's success. Tony Vitello is building some of that success also where those expectations are so much higher. And I know they got a very young team. I think they have one senior that's going to be gone in Hunter Ensley. But there's still no excuse. I mean, this is a team that won it all last year. They had high hopes coming into the season. They started off great, and they didn't play well the last couple months of the year. I mean, let's call it what it was. This team isn't clutch like past Tony Vitello teams. They lack a bit of that magic that we've seen with his clubs before. So, yeah, I think it would be a disappointment if they can't get out of their own regional and at least make it the super regional. Now, if they get to the super regional, I think you could easily say, well, hey, they won a national title. They floundered for a month and a half, 2 months of the season, and they were still able to get to the final 16 of college baseball. That's not too bad, especially considering what they should have coming back next year. But, you know, fail at home the way they lost a bunch of series late in the year at home. Yeah, it's absolutely a disappointment for what this program is expected of now.
After a 7-game thrilling Stanley Cup final last year between Florida and Edmonton, they are both back in the Cup final. Is there any added interest given the rematch and Connor McDavid for the casual sport fan for the Stanley Cup final?
I really thought the Four Nations face-off would feed more into NHL interest, and I just have not seen it. I don't think so. I don't think for the casual fan there's any more interest than there was when these two teams did battle a year ago. And that's unfortunate because, you know, we talked about it on this show, Jared. It was awesome watching those teams go as hard as they did. I laugh at all this. We have John McClain on our show, and he's like, no one should play flag football in the Olympics if you're in the NFL. No owner's going to allow it to happen. They could get hurt. They could pull something. They could tear an ACL. And it's just, you're not going to do it, right? And I'm thinking, well, look at the Four Nations face-off. Did you like that? When guys went full on for their countries in the middle of a season. And John, well, yeah, they do. But, you know, it's not going to be that way in the NFL. And I kind of hate that because I want NFL players to have the ability to go win a gold medal for their country if the sport that they play is now suddenly in the Olympics. And I like that national pride element of it. But I really thought, Jared, it was going to lead to a lot more interest in the league. And personally, I have not seen that. I have not checked the ratings round by round. But I'm not feeling a lot of buzz about the NHL playoffs.
They've been pretty bad as far as the American TV market is concerned. In the NBA, the New York Knicks have forced a game six. That'll be tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. Who are you rooting for, New York or Indiana?
I'm rooting for the Knicks. And I grew up a New York Knicks hater. I love the Chicago Bulls.
I was going to say, you must have been a Jordan fan.
I was a huge Jordan guy, and I hated the Knicks, hated those series, hated Patrick Ewing, hated Charles Oakley, John Starks, all of those teams. So I was not a Knicks guy growing up. I am right now. Here's what I am with the NBA as of now. I root for the story at all times. I don't do that with all sports. There are players I like. There are coaches I like. There are teams I like more than others. Not really in the NBA. Like, I want the story, and having the New York market and that fan base in the NBA Finals is a way better story than Pacers Thunder in the NBA Finals. So I'm rooting for New York. I was happy to see him win last night. I kind of like the celebrities at the game and all of that. Give me the sideshow with the NBA. Give me the circus. Give me the Knicks to battle back and win this series in seven.
Who is the best player in the NBA?
Best player in the NBA. Oh, gosh. I mean, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander just won the MVP. Jokic, Gilgeous-Alexander. I mean, what's weird right now about the NBA is the guys that you first think about as the best basketball players in the world are old, right? LeBron James, Steph Curry, Kevin Durant. Those are the first three names that come to mind. Giannis is another guy that comes to mind, but I wouldn't say he's the best in the league right now. And that's the problem I think they're having. They've got some really good young players in the league, but Anthony Edwards is another good example. But I don't immediately, if you say who's the best player in the league, there's not one name that immediately pops to mind. Like they would have been, you know, in the 80s where everyone would have said Bird or Magic. In the 90s, most everyone would have said Michael Jordan right away. Kobe Bryant was that guy for a while. I don't think there's an obvious one player at this point in time, and that's a big problem for the league. Is there an obvious guy that comes to mind for you?
No. So here's what I'm thinking. The thing that's tough for me is it went from Jordan to Kobe to LeBron, and now, like, maybe Steph a little bit in there, but now I'm waiting for who the next guy is, and I just don't know who it is because, you know, one year it looks like it's Jokic, and then the next year it looks like it's SGA, and then, you know, everybody tells me that Halliburton's no good, but I'm watching him play. I think Halliburton's awesome for Indiana. There's a bunch of good players right now in the NBA, but there's not one guy like Kobe that's like, okay, yeah, turn on the TV because you know Kobe's going to be there, and I do think the NBA probably needs that, but again, you play your way into that. Tatum, you know, could have been in that after they won the title last year. You play your way into being Kobe or Jordan or LeBron, and I don't know who that next guy is. And it might be Cooper Flagg. I don't know.
Yeah, that's the hope, is that it's Cooper Flagg, I would think, for the league. Yeah, I mean, SGA is a guy I keep hearing about. I'm not watching a lot of Oklahoma City Thunder games, and I'm probably not alone in that. I don't know as much about him. Then you've got the European stars, Jokic, Luka, is another guy I would put in that mix. But yeah, it's a great question. And not only that they don't have that guy, but who needs to be the guy, right? Like if there was a consensus player, like this player needs to be the next Kobe in the NBA, Like, who is that player? I don't think it's Anthony Edwards. Maybe it is Cooper Flagg, who hasn't played a single game in the NBA yet. But it's a really good question, and it's sad. But when I think of the NBA right now, I'm thinking about guys who are aging out of the league. I'm thinking about LeBron. I'm thinking about Kevin Durant. I'm thinking about Steph Curry. And I'm not thinking about those young stars.
Chad Withrow, as always, great stuff presented by the Southern Bank of Tennessee. That's it for us. Vandy pregame is next. Stillman and Company. We'll see everybody Monday at 2:00.